This is the takeaway for Tuesday, March 28th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Sarah Gonzalez. Todd and I are filling in together for John Hockenberry this week.
That's right. And we start in Washington at the top of this hour and back on the investigation into possible ties between the Trump campaign and Russia. On Monday, President Trump's advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, agreed to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee over his contacts with Russians, including a previously undisclosed meeting with the head of Russia's state-owned development bank during the 2016 campaign, while that bank was under U.S. sanctions. Other Trump campaign officials and associates, meanwhile, are being invited for now for questioning. We're not in subpoena territory yet. One longtime Trump ally says he's excited to testify. Roger Stone is the self-described political dirty trickster and longtime advisor to Donald Trump, and he's offered to appear before the House Intelligence Committee. Stone says he has nothing to hide about contacts with Russians or with the people who hacked the DNC or with WikiLeaks, who rocked the presidential campaign by releasing John Podesta's emails. The New York Times reports that the FBI is investigating Roger Stone for all of this, but Stone said the other day that he wanted to appear before Democrats on the committee so that he could, quote, spank them like children. I spoke with Roger Stone, who says that he's been in touch with the president recently, though he's not talking about the circumstances or the contents of those communications. Stone says he still hasn't been informed by the FBI that he's under investigation, but the FBI and members of the Intel committees are interested. Stone seemed to publicly predict the release of Podesta's emails. Stone was also in touch with the alleged hacker, Guccifer 2.0. But Stone says that all of the claims are just a smear campaign and that his contact with Guccifer 2.0 happened after the hacks took place.
I've communicated with them because, of course, I'm a prolific writer of memos. I find that that's the most efficient way to communicate with the president. I worked for him for 30 years. But additionally, we have spoken, as I've said, from time to time by phone. I have not spoken to the president on the phone recently, but I have heard from the president recently.
You've heard from him in what manner?
I really am not going to characterize our personal communications, either the content or the quantity, because it's a good way to get them cut off. And this isn't about bragging and trying to be important in the current Washington, other than to say, we'll leave it there.
Okay. Well, Mr. Stone, of course, you have characterized in many places the ongoing investigations into possible Russian connections to the presidential campaign or possible collusion as bogus. I know that you still stand by that. Have you been informed by anyone in federal law enforcement, the FBI or the DOJ, that you are the subject of an investigation?
No, I haven't. I'm banking on the New York Times account. I'm also banking on the account that the story in The Smoking Gun has an attack on me in a long piece that contains information which revealed that I'd had some exchange with a hacker called Guccifer 2.0, who may or may not be a Russian asset. But what they don't tell you is that that communication comes after the hacking of which he is accused of, and I am accused in the same narrative of colluding with him, when in fact our exchange, which I have made entirely public by releasing the two screenshots, all of our public back and forth that anybody could read, and a limited number of personal exchanges, it's benign. It's certainly not collusion in any way, and it comes after the fact. So I would have needed a time machine to collude.
Mr. Stone, of course, you have offered voluntarily to go in front of the House Intelligence Committee to testify there voluntarily, so saying a subpoena is not necessary. Members of that committee, of course, will point out the many, many times in public and a couple of times before emails from John Podesta that were so important in the presidential campaign were released, and suggest that you had prior knowledge that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks would release them. You're going to be prepared to answer that question.
Yes. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the facts, and we're going to look at exactly what I said. When a member of that body said, Stone said Podesta's emails would be released, I never said that anywhere in any forum.
You said that John Podesta would soon be in the barrel.
Yes, I did. Meaning his business activities, as Manafort's word, would be under public scrutiny. You'll notice I didn't hashtag WikiLeaks, hashtag Julian Assange. I'm sorry. It looks brilliant, and it becomes true.
You've known and worked with Paul Manafort for many, many years, and there's a lot coming out now about his relationship with Viktor Yanukovych and his political consulting for Oleg Deripaska. Did you know back in 2005, 2006 about the business relationships that Mr. Manafort had with Deripaska and his advancing of Russian interests as reported by the AP?
No, I did not. I was entirely unaware that he had, in fact, had Russian clients, and I believe that somewhere I was quoted as saying that he did not, and I was incorrect. He had never mentioned it, and I had never heard about it. And in our, you know, circle of former partners, recognize this is long after a period in which Paul and I have been partners. I have no association with Yanukovych, but I was well aware of his work because for one cycle, I worked in Ukraine for a small splinter pro-Western, pro-U.S. splinter party from the Orange Revolution to help them get 20 seats in the Rada, which is their legislature, which is the minimum to be in the, you know, should be in the House. I was running against Manafort's candidate and Yanukovych. I was only there for one cycle. We were woefully underfunded, and we were not affiliated with Manafort's candidate's party of origins.
What political party did you work for then?
I worked for the party of Volodymyr Litvin, who would later become a speaker of the Rada.
Is there any concern that Americans should have that political operatives like Mr. Manafort, like you, were doing so much work for foreign politicians and then coming back and doing work for an American politician who became president? Is that an area of concern, do you think?
No, because the reason that they hire you in these foreign countries has nothing to do with your influence in the United States. It has to do with taking communications and organizational and other strategic techniques that we take for granted in this country abroad. When I was working for Litvin's party, I first advocated the yard sign to Ukrainian politics. Comrade, his genius put the name on sign, put in the front yard. The genius. They loved it.
Mr. Stone, you know, I read a tweet from WikiLeaks. It says, Roger Stone continues to troll the media into increasing his profile by feeding false claims of contact with WikiLeaks. Now, quite apart from WikiLeaks, as somebody who's as experienced a political operator as you are and experienced in the media as you are, WikiLeaks kind of crows that you're trolling the media into increasing your profile. And I was hoping you could let us into the strategy a little bit.
WikiLeaks says they've never communicated with me through an intermediary. Well, if that's true, then I am completely innocent of the accusation that I could have known about Podesta's email or about the scope and plan and timing to drop their information, which, of course, those two things happen. Therefore, I'm either clairvoyant and a really good guesser, or what I told you is true. I know somebody who is a mutual friend of Assange who predicted to me in August that October would see the release of enormous amount of information on Hillary and the Clintons, and that it would include everything, which I took to mean specifically the emails that were deleted by Huma Abedin and Cheryl Mills. I don't have the firepower or the reach of, you know, the networks or even the cable news networks or some of the mega mainstream media outlets that are my critics. And therefore, yes, I have to be somewhat provocative to be able to even get a platform to make my point about a view regarding anything from the matter of history or what has happened in this bogus campaign in which I think it will yet be proven that there was no Russian collusion. There's one thing that is not in my bag of tricks, and that is treason. As a dirty trickster, I spot this as the biggest Democratic dirty trick of all. The evidence of Russian collusion is a Hillary Clinton campaign press release. It's a meme invented by Podesta for which there is no evidence.
And so you're looking forward, as you've said, to testimony in front of the Intelligence Committee, House or Senate, on Capitol Hill. And just to be clear, and for the record, Mr. Stone, you would answer all of their questions under oath the exact same way you answer them to media people like me.
By and large, yes. I mean, my lawyers may want to advise me otherwise, but I really have nothing to hide. And the sooner we can clear the air on this, we can get back to further exploring what other kind of surveillance may have been put on Donald Trump.
So, Mr. Stone, before we let you go, I know that you're itching to testify in front of the House Intelligence Committee. Have they invited you yet? Do you have a date? When is America going to hear from you under oath?
Well, I remember they just got the letter from my attorney last Friday. They did acknowledge receipt, but we have not heard from them. I also earlier, as the New York Times reported, had a letter asking me to preserve all documents pertaining to a Senate investigation. I welcome that also. Perfect example again. John McCain has now said on CNN that Roger Stone should be compelled to come before the Senate and say what he and explain his ties to the Russians. I have none. And his ties to Yukonovich. I have none. None.
Roger Stone, political advisor and author of The Making of the President 2016. Thanks for joining us once again.
Many thanks, and I don't know how quickly I'll be before Congress, but I have some time to think about what I'm going to wear.
Along with Roger Stone, Paul Manafort was an even bigger player in the Trump campaign, who is now being investigated for his potential collusion with Russia during the election and for his financial ties to Russia. Manafort also happens to live in Trump Tower. He purchased an apartment on the 43rd floor in 2006 using a shell company, and it was that transaction and others that our colleagues here at WNYC are looking into. Andrea Bernstein is special projects editor for WNYC, and she joins me now. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Sarah.
So we should say off the bat that a real estate purchase through a shell company, while it may draw suspicion, it's not illegal. But what does raise suspicion, Andrea?
Well, in New York, apartments are really expensive. So one of the things that the federal government has started to look at is the purchase of apartments through shell companies because they're so hard to trace. You really don't even know in many cases who they are. And what the Treasury Department has said in general is that one-third of these types of transactions in New York, because the real estate is so expensive, merit scrutiny. So for that reason, we thought, that's interesting that he's following this pattern. And also it's Paul Manafort, who is already under multiple investigation for his foreign business and political ties.
And you and WNYC reporter Ilya Meritz looked at three of Manafort's real estate transactions in New York City. What do they all have in common?
So we first found his apartment in Trump Tower because we've been looking at Trump Tower. It is, after all, the president's New York home. And we've been looking at all of the people who own apartments. They make payments every month to the Trump Organization. And we found that Manafort had actually put the apartment in his own name in 2015, but that a shell company linked to him had actually bought it 9 years earlier. So he buys it in 2006, he transfers it into his name in 2015, and then he borrows a lot of money against it. And what we found was three homes around New York City where this same pattern repeated. A shell company buys an apartment for all cash, then sometime later it's transferred back into Paul Manafort's name, and then he borrows against it. In all, $12 million of borrowing just between 2015 and 2017 now.
And you and Ilya spoke with nine current and former law enforcement and real estate experts who say that all of this sort of follows a certain kind of pattern.
Right. And I do want to say that the documents per se do not show that any legal lines were crossed, and Manafort says he didn't do anything wrong. But what the experts we spoke to said is, wow, that is really weird. One federal agent who investigates financial transactions actually said to us, wow, can I have that? And that agent is now looking into this.
So, Andrea, can we in any way connect the shell companies that Manafort used to buy real estate to his dealings with Russian oligarchs?
Well, there's a very interesting coincidence of timing. We know that this contract, which was found by the AP, was signed in 2006 with the Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska. We know that in 2006, Paul Manafort, through an LLC, purchased his apartment in Trump Tower with all cash. And we also know that the company that signed the contract and Manafort's consulting company, Davis Manafort, and the LLC all had the same address in Virginia. And one really interesting fact, the name of the LLC is John Hanna LLC. John is Paul Manafort's middle name, and Hanna is his business partner's middle name. So there is a connection. Exactly what it means, and if it's some legal lines were crossed, that's up to investigators to find out now.
Andrea Bernstein is Special Projects Editor for WNYC. Thanks, Andrea.
Thanks, Sarah.
And I am Sarah Gonzalez in with Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Later on this hour, we continue our series on the American jury system. What's your experience been like as one of 12 angry people?
This is Mark from the Jersey Shore. I've sat on a jury in an assault case. There was one eyewitness, the victim. The defendant was found guilty one day after the holdouts got what they wanted, a meal and a room on the state's dime. The convict's protestations of innocence seemed alarmingly genuine. And during the years in the meantime, it has become clear that eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable. I wonder if we did the right thing.
Nell wrote this to us on Facebook. I've been called for jury duty several times, and as the primary caregiver for my four young kids, I've not been able to serve. I'm sure that others share my problem. If there could be a child care stipend, I would love to participate. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Join this conversation on our Facebook page.
I'm Sarah Gonzalez, in with Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. President Trump has failed to dismantle the Affordable Care Act for now, but today he has set his sights on another piece of President Obama's legacy to pick apart, the Clean Power Plan. The CPP, as it's known, created a roadmap for closing down hundreds of heavily polluting coal power plants. It stops new plants from opening and replaces them with wind and solar farms. Trump's latest executive order would decimate the Clean Power Plan and scale back other environmental regulations, including the ones aimed at reducing vehicle emissions. At a rally in Kentucky last week, the president promised his actions would bring back coal mining jobs.
As we speak, we are preparing new executive actions to save our coal industry and to save our wonderful coal miners from continuing to be put out of work. The miners are coming back.
Many economists are skeptical that rolling back these rules would actually restore coal jobs. The demand for coal has been shrinking for years. In just a minute, we'll hear from an economist who agrees that the Clean Power Plan is bad for business. But if environmentalists take the Trump administration to court, it could be years before the actions take effect. Coral Davenport is an energy and environment reporter for the New York Times. Hi, Coral. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Sarah. It's great to be with you.
In terms of what this could mean, what rolling back this regulation could mean, in 2015, almost every country signed a climate pact. Almost every country agreed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This is the Paris Agreement. Now, the White House has not explicitly said that it will pull out of the Paris Agreement. But, Coral, you write that undoing Obama's Clean Power Plan would make it virtually impossible for the United States to meet the goal that it pledged to the world in an international agreement. So what are the consequences of this?
So under the 2015 Paris Agreement, the United States, the largest economy in the world, largest historic greenhouse polluter, put forth a pledge that the U.S. would cut its emissions about 26% from 2005 levels by 2025. In order to meet that commitment, the U.S. would both have to fully implement the Clean Power Plan and additional new regulations on top of that. if you take away the Clean Power Plan, it pretty much means there's no way the U.S. will be able to meet its commitment. And it also sends a signal to the rest of the world that it's not interested in trying.
And we know that Trump and his administration have called climate change policies some names. When could changes take effect, though, Coral? There is an issue of legal challenges.
What we'll see today is an executive order. But as one legal expert told me, the order itself has about the legal impact of a tweet. He will be telling his Environmental Protection Agency administrator, you go start doing this. That's a lot easier said than done. Those regulations were put forth under an existing law, under a very rigorous regulatory process mandated by statute. This whole process could easily take up to 2 years, maybe even more. And there's certainly no question that it will be met every step along the way with resistance and also with lawsuits. And at the end of the day, the expectation is probably this will end up before the Supreme Court, before we really know what's going to happen.
Other environmental regulations are on the line here, too. How much of Obama's legacy are we looking at?
So the Clean Power Plan really is the heart of President Obama's climate legacy. But he also put forth a sort of a suite of smaller executive orders, memorandums. And so it will be a lot easier for President Trump to quickly sweep those away. Last year, President Obama announced a temporary ban on new coal leasing on federal lands. That was one of those executive orders that presidents do with a stroke of a pen. It will be undone. Another thing, this is sort of a wonky and obscure thing, but it has a lot of impact. President Obama's economists essentially created a price for the cost of carbon pollution. Each ton of carbon pollution, they assign a cost of $36 per ton. That number equates to the amount of damage to the economy done by each ton of carbon pollution. So you multiply that by, you know, hundreds or millions of tons of carbon pollution annually, and that comes out to an annual price tag for the economic damage done by the impacts of climate change, by rising sea levels, increased flooding, increased drought. And that was very important because when the Obama administration put forth its climate regulations, they acknowledged that they would have an economic cost, that they would hurt the coal industry, but they were able to kind of pair that, do a cost-benefit analysis and say, but it will prevent sort of this level of economic damage. It's expected that the Trump administration is going to basically try to revise, review, and probably eliminate this social cost of carbon. Once they wipe it from the books, they can create new regulations that are much, much weaker and do a cost-benefit analysis that does not take into account the economic impact of climate change, sort of takes away the rationale for stringent, ambitious regulations and creates an economic rationale for extremely weak and industry-friendly regulations, which is what we would expect to see emerging at some point once the Obama rules are rolled back.
Coral Davenport is an energy and environment reporter for the New York Times. Coral, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
While environmentalists and people who worry about climate change may be dreading the repeal of the Clean Power Plan, which you just heard about, many in the energy business are celebrating. Critics of the CPP believe that the plan would have increased energy costs and hit low-income people with higher costs. The CPP regulations have also been blamed for shutting down older coal-fired power plants and for halting construction of new ones, putting more pressure on jobs in that sector. Does repeal of the Clean Power Plan mean a 21st century renaissance for the coal industry? Wayne Weingarten is senior fellow at the Pacific Research Institute. He studied the potential economic impact of the CPP, and he joins me now to explain why its repeal might be good for the average American. Wayne Weingarten, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Todd. Thank you for having me.
Well, you've said that the CPP could and would mean higher costs for people on limited incomes. What have you found?
We found that right now, energy costs are a much larger burden for lower income people, and that makes sense, right? They have a smaller budget, and energy costs are pretty much a fixed cost. So they're more burdensome on lower income individuals. And when you increase those costs, and the CPP would have significantly increased energy costs, you're going to have a much larger impact, not only on lower income families in lower-income households, but you're also going to have a regional impact. So the Southeast and the Midwest were going to be hurt significantly more than, let's say, the West Coast would have been.
And what have you found about the actual impact? Take a family making $50,000 in Canton, Ohio, if you like.
If you're talking about an average family and $50,000, you're talking about an average family. Right now, they have about 2.7% of their income is devoted towards energy costs. And if you would have had the CPP, you're talking about another 0.5% of their income that would have been forced into expenditures on energy. And obviously, when you look at the stagnating income that we've had, and that's really been the bottom 50, bottom 60% of households haven't seen their incomes grow since 2000 once you adjust for inflation. You put these regulations on top of that, and you're really putting a lot of families in a very large financial bind.
So, Wayne, it's all understandable. This was the same argument that was made against cap and trade when Democrats tried to pass that through Congress in the mid-2000s. There are, of course, ways around this. Congress decided that health insurance could also be a burden on families, the cost of premiums, so they subsidized it. Why not do that here?
We have to remember, when you subsidize, subsidies don't come from heaven. They're not something that's magically created. When a government offers a subsidy, it takes money from one place and gives it to someplace else. That transfer on net has no economic or positive economic impact. What you are doing are creating a lot of distortions, creating a lot of inefficiencies, and that overall is going to reduce our economic growth. And part of the solution to a lot of these issues, whether it's health insurance, whether it's energy costs, is reinvigorating the economy, reinvigorating growth, so we can get back up to the average 3% growth that we've seen since the end of World War II.
But I wonder if your studies into the costs on individual families also include the economic price of carbon and the price of the impact of climate change.
There are investments we can be making currently that would impact that. Why we're not building more nuclear plants, which is a very clean, sustainable energy source, that is a great solution that we should be investigating more. What we want to do is empower people and empower entrepreneurs in innovation. That doesn't come from Washington, D.C. That comes from the thousands, the millions of people and the innovators. Bureaucracies don't innovate. People do. So part of what, when we're talking about the cost of climate change and how do we address that, we want to have a lot of experiments going on. We want to empower the economy and empower people to come up with these solutions, not direct them from Washington, D.C.
Wayne Weingarten, a senior fellow at the Pacific Research Institute. Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you.
Montana is one of 13 states this year considering legislation that would prohibit the use of foreign law in state courts. Members of the state legislature have passed the controversial Senate Bill 97. It must still pass a final vote before it goes to Democratic Governor Steve Bullock. Now, Montana's bill does not single out Sharia law, though opponents of the bill say that's intentional, meant to stave off legal challenges. They argue the bill is still rooted in xenophobia and driven by a fear of Islam. We reached out to Montana Senator Keith Regeer, who sponsored the bill, as well as the governor, and did not hear back. But we are speaking with Representative Shane Morgeau, a state legislator in Montana and a member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. He attended the hearings and felt that the nature of the testimony was harmful and redundant.
It was all about religion. It was all about the Sharia law and the extremists who want to put Sharia law into our law. And the whole point of what many of us that oppose this legislation, when I say many of us, is that we already have the protections in our law to provide equality for religion and free speech. And we don't need this law when we already have a system of case law and constitution in place. We don't need something to protect something that is the greatest protection for all of us.
How often do defendants cite foreign laws as a defense in court? Is this a bill that we really need to protect people?
I've never heard of anyone in Montana, if someone lost a dispute or some sort of agreement or argument because the court arbitrarily pulled in some random law that wasn't allowed for under our constitution. I've never heard of it. And the proponents, the sponsor and carrier of the bill in the House side, gave examples of these individuals entered into a contract for marriage in a different country and came over here And it's like, well, if that's the agreement they had, then let them abide by the agreement that they put in place. You know, we shouldn't be dictating what people agree to in those agreements from other places. And this law does that.
I want to ask you a little bit about how this would affect tribal nations in a bit. But first, I just want to try to understand how this could come up in court. So let's take domestic abuse, for example. And we should say that there are a lot of interpretations of Sharia law and that it is not followed consistently by all Muslims. But one argument I think that was brought up was that this would allow the wives of Muslim men who hit them, this would sort of protect the wives because Muslim men would not be able to say, well, this is in line with my religion. Is that correct?
Totally incorrect. I mean, in Montana, we have laws for assault. We have laws for abuse, for domestic abuse. And those laws are criminal laws. Those laws, you're not exempt from hitting someone or hurting someone.
Right.
And we have discussions about these types of things all the time where people try to assert religion as a buffer for them to discriminate, so to speak. And I think our courts have done a very good job in interpreting what our Constitution really means when it comes to those types of issues.
So, Representative Morjo, you're also a member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes, and you have an interesting perspective on how this legislation would infringe on tribal sovereignty since tribal nations are technically foreign. Can you give me examples of how you think this would impact the relationship between tribes and the state?
This legislation brings into question the common international legal agreements that many tribal members, like myself, enter into. We have the Blackfeet tribe here in Montana and near the Canadian border, and we also have the Kootenai tribe, which is part of my tribe. So their historical boundaries cross the Canadian border, and many individuals enter into contracts and agreements with other tribal members across the border. And so that in itself, I said, is problematic because it creates a structure where it would basically say those are foreign law.
So the House and Senate have both passed this. The bill now goes to the Democratic governor to either sign it into law or veto it. Where do you think it will go?
I think it's an attack on anyone who has different culture and religion from other places, because it says everything that's not from here is foreign and essentially deserves extra scrutiny. So I think the governor will recognize that and recognize that that's not good for Montana. It's not good for who we are in this state and in this country. And I think he will recognize that and veto that legislation.
Representative Shane Morjo is a Democratic state legislator and member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes. Representative Morjo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. Tomorrow is breakup day for Brexit. UK Prime Minister Theresa May is expected to trigger Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty. And when she does, it's the beginning of the end of the formal relationship between the UK and the European Union. We've been living together. Both sides are expected to take about 2 years to negotiate the official terms of this divorce deal. Article 50 has never been triggered before, but it's expected it will take the form of a letter from the UK's permanent EU representative to the EU Council President Donald Tusk. Gillian Tett is managing editor of the Financial Times, and she's here with what to expect from the months of negotiation that are coming up. Gillian, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be on the show.
Well, divorce is a foreboding term. It's probably accurate here. What do the Brits want from their terms of this split?
Well, divorce certainly is a very ugly term, and however you look at the future right now, it does look like the negotiations are going to be pretty ugly, because the Brits started off hoping that they would be able to get a lot of market access without having to sacrifice very much. They wanted all the good bits of being in the European Union, i.e. freedom to trade as they wanted and have their financial services essentially operate across the European Union without having to accept some of the key pillars such as free movement of people or capital. Now, the problem is that as time has passed, it's got nastier and nastier. And essentially, the Europeans are saying that you can't have access to the market. You're going to have to basically agree to divorce and then start talking about a new treaty. They've slapped a bill on the British as well, about 60 billion euros or sterling, depending on how you calculate it. And there's going to be a lot of fighting, a lot of argument. My personal bet is, unfortunately, that probably they will end up leaving without a clear-cut deal in place, which means essentially they'll have to fall back onto the World Treaty Organization agreement.
Now, does Europe have something to lose here by taking a hard line? I mean, presumably having a tougher negotiation costs Europe money as well. And I wonder if this hard line, you know, you have to leave entirely, we'll negotiate later, you get no concessions, whether this isn't kind of a just a negotiating posture.
Well, certainly everybody in the business community desperately hopes that what's going on right now is purely a bit of political shadow boxing, if you like. And the hope is that once the serious talk starts, that some element of compromise will be found. But sadly, as anybody who's ever been through a divorce knows, once you start flinging a lot of mud around, once you draw red lines, once you both get very angry and embittered, it's very hard to actually get people back to the table and be sensible and rational about this. The European Union does have things to lose in the sense that they have big trading relationships with the UK, but they also have things to lose because if the UK is seen to exit easily, that might encourage other members of the European Union to think that they needn't stay inside the European Union either. And there's a growing realization in both Paris and Berlin that they need to take a hard line towards the UK simply to keep the rest of the European Union together.
The vote that took place, Gillian Tett, over the summer in the UK was a very broad question. Stay or leave? Sort of a very digestible political question. Now we're getting down into the details. What does the political pressure from voters look like as you talk about the minutiae of trade, of financial services? Is the public really connected to this level of what Brexit means?
Surveys suggest that when people voted by a very narrow majority for Brexit, they were voting partly because they were fed up with the status quo. They wanted to give the establishment a kick in the teeth. In some cases, they were voting because they didn't like the idea of lots of East European immigrants coming in. But most people were not voting against the idea of a single market. They were not voting against the idea of having freedom to travel and to go and live in places like Spain or France. And the implications of a full Brexit are not particularly clearly understood at all. For the most part, the UK voters have been shielded from this in the last 6-9 months because actually the UK economy has performed pretty well, much better than most people expected. And there's been a sort of halo effect going on where people have thought, well, OK, so the doomsters told us that if we voted for Brexit, everything would fall apart. It hasn't happened. Therefore, it's going to be OK. Personally, I think that is an incredibly dangerous illusion. I think that when Brexit does start to bite, there's going to be much more in the way of economic shock. But for the moment, it seems that voters are not in a mood to call for a second vote and not really in a mood to rebel either, because there's a feeling that this is all very complex and technical. It's been fine so far. So why should anyone worry?
We're looking at a 2-year timeline here. Is there a chance within that 2 years that British voters turn around and say, oh, maybe we should reconcile. Let's keep it together.
So there's a lot of wishful thinking and a lot of speculation that actually there will be a second vote. The problem is that there are very few parliamentary or political mechanisms to make that second vote happen. And Parliament did stage a challenge of sorts. It demanded to have a vote, but it has now got through Parliament. There is a very logical reason to say that once the terms of a divorce are agreed, that divorce should be put back to the UK just to check, or the UK voters check, that that's what voters actually wanted. Because remember, when the whole issue of Brexit was first put on the table, UK voters were told that it wouldn't be a full-blown exclusion from the single market. I mean, they were told essentially nothing much would change. There would just be curbs on immigration. And what's happened in the last 6 months is that that vision has been stealthily changed over and over again. And we've gone from really a very mild version of Brexit that was on the table before to a very draconian version without much of a political vote.
Gillian Tett, U.S. Managing Editor for the Financial Times. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Jury will reach a verdict.
Jury duty helps decide how our country is.
We were talking about the time you beat jury duty.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody messes with my jury but me.
Is there any reason you can think of that you would not be able to decide this case in a fair and impartial manner?
No.
Is this really a jury of their peers?
Oh, what are we doing now?
I guess we talk.
This week on The Takeaway, we're exploring ideas for improving our modern jury system in our series of Our Peers. And Todd, you, like me, have never served on a jury.
I've been called so many times, I've never been picked. It just left me to my fantasy of being the one holdout for a verdict, the guy who won't budge, but I'll just have to keep dreaming of it.
Okay, so once you are picked for jury service, you're in that box. How do you know what to do? Apparently, there are jury instructions. They tell jurors what they need to know about the law in a particular case and how to come up with the verdict. They explain some pretty critical terms like reasonable doubt. But over history, jury instructions have tended to be full of legal jargon and antiquated or complicated wording. Some states have worked hard in recent years to put jury instructions into plain English so jurors can better understand what's being asked of them. The stakes are high. And Nancy Martyr, who studies the language of jury instructions and also serves on a committee that writes them for the state of Illinois, says we've still got a ways to go.
Jury instructions are written by committees of lawyers and judges, and they try and do the best job that they can and make sure that the instructions state the law clearly, but they don't always remember what it's like for an ordinary citizen who has not been through law school and practicing law to hear terms that are legal in nature. And so the goal of jury instructions should be that they're written so that jurors can understand them.
Are jury instructions the same in every court all over the country, or do they differ by state?
They're the same in federal court throughout the country, but in state court, they differ from state to state. So each state writes its own jury instructions. They can be quite different. And the states that have revisited their jury instructions and tried to make them in plain language have done a much better job at conveying the information to ordinary people.
Right. And there have been efforts in the past decade to sort of update the jury instruction language to make it a little bit maybe more conversational. Can you give us some examples of how the wording has changed over time? I've never been selected for jury duty. I've always wanted to be. I'm from California, and I know that in California, jurors used to be told to look for, quote, a preponderance of evidence. They don't use that language anymore. Now they call that more likely than not, which is, I would say, more conversational. Can you give us some more examples?
Yes. Well, I hope you do get further along.
Me
for
too.
Jury selection. California undertook a great effort, and it took them 6, 7, 8 years to do this. They rewrote their instructions, and they used linguists and lawyers and public comment, and I think they did a very good job of doing it. Here's an example. This is one of the best ones that comes out of California. So the old version was, failure of recollection is common. Innocent misrecollection is not uncommon.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, okay. What is a misrecollection? But the new version is, people often forget things or make mistakes in what they remember.
Okay.
So you're trying to make it in ordinary language and to explain it in a way that your neighbor would understand. Here's another example. And this is reasonable doubt. The old way was, it's defined as follows. It is not a mere possible doubt because everything relating to human affairs is open to some possible or imaginary doubt. It is that state of the case which, after the entire comparison and consideration of all the evidence, leaves the minds of the jurors in that condition that they cannot say they feel an abiding conviction of the truth of the charge.
Okay, that's very the old
vague.
Version.
That's the old version.
And the new version?
The new version. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is proof that leaves you with an abiding conviction that the charge is true. The evidence need not eliminate all possible doubt because everything in life is open to some possible or imaginary doubt. In deciding whether the prosecution has proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt, you must impartially compare and consider all the evidence. Unless the evidence proves the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, he's entitled to an acquittal and you must find him not guilty.
Nancy, I have to tell you, this
still seems incredibly complicated to me.
Well, here's the challenge. These are broad concepts, and so it's very hard to be specific, and a room of lawyers probably couldn't agree. Even the Supreme Court struggles to say what reasonable doubt means, and usually it says what it doesn't mean. So it's a broad concept, and intentionally so, I think, because it allows it to be a little bit malleable for each group of jurors who hears it. There are some terms that we're never going to be able to define precisely, but at least the jurors should understand the words that are being used.
What else do we need to do to make jury instructions more clear and to make it easier for jurors to do their jobs?
One is a written copy of the instructions. So traditionally, the jury instructions are read at the end of the trial by the judge. And this can take anywhere from a half hour to several hours. And it's very hard for people to sit and listen and pay attention and understand everything. Having a written copy, your own individual written copy, is an aid, and being able to take notes and mark things on the written copy is also an aid. One thing that's rarely done that would be very helpful is if after the jurors are instructed on the law by the judge, if they could ask questions. Very few judges permit that. And if in committees that draft these instructions, if they actually tested the instructions on lay people, that would be a good thing too.
And what would you tell jurors going into their service?
I would remind jurors that it's a group effort. So if they don't understand reasonable doubt or if they find it too broad a concept, the whole point is to be able to discuss that with fellow jurors and to see the different perspectives and ideas that people have, the different understandings of that. The other thing, some states have permitted jurors to submit written questions to the judge after a witness is done testifying. That's another way of getting your questions answered. They don't have to understand the instructions completely on their own, but they certainly have to work hard and pay attention.
Nancy Marder, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Nancy Marder is professor of law at Chicago Kent College of Law and director of the Justice John Paul Stevens Jury Center. She also sits on the committee in Illinois that makes jury instructions in civil cases.
This is Andrew from Louisville, Kentucky. I've been summoned and sat on a jury. And in Kentucky, where I live, you get $12 a day, which, may I say, barely covered parking and lunch. It seems that most people get compensation from work, you know, but I wasn't that lucky.
Well, in Washington, D.C., you get $4, Andrew. We'll have more about reforming our modern jury system when our series continues tomorrow. Have you ever served on a jury? Are you dying to, like me? Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us. We're at The Takeaway. And Sarah, I want to thank you for being here. It's such a pleasure having you here. Thanks for taking half the work, by the way.
It's so fun to be here.
Boy, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for listening. I am Taz Willick.
And I am Sarah Gonzalez. We are both filling in for John Hockenberry this week. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
PRI, Public Radio International.